from stpetecatalyst.com.
Hello again, I'm Bill DeYoung, and this is, you guessed it, the Catalyst Sessions. It's Thursday, and once again, I'm so happy to introduce you to my friend and your friend, Roy Peter Clark. Hey, buddy.
Hey, man, got my Rays gear on. I want to just root the boys on with a little luck. By this time, midnight tonight, the team will have earned a place in the World Series, first time since 2008. Go Rays.
You may have noticed that the Catalyst Sessions is very, very St. Pete-centric. That's the way we intended it. That's what we want to do. And Roy is one of our favorite guests. Roy teaches writing at the Poynter Institute. He has for at least, 75, 100 years.
Yeah, at least. Not since Genesis, but since Exodus.
Is that Old or New Testament? I don't know that stuff. So listen, you had an essay in the Times this week, which made me laugh out loud, as they usually do. And I wanted to ask, in honor of that, I have an image behind me from the book Caps for Sale.
Yeah. Which
is mentioned in the essay. And I had, this was one of my favorites from being a kid here in St. Pete, going to Northwest Elementary School.
Wow.
Watching Captain Kangaroo every morning, where the captain, or maybe it was Mr. Green Jeans, would read a book, and Caps for Sale was a favorite. But you referenced that in this piece that you wrote about baseball caps, and I was hoping that maybe you'd read some of that for us today.
Yeah, you know, it made me, so I have very, very clear memories of my childhood, which are accompanied since I was the oldest of three boys, that my mom and dad saved a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. And kept a lot of stuff and kept baby books and photographs and things like that. So I'm not exactly sure what I'm actually remembering, whether I'm remembering the events or whether I'm remembering in some cases like the photographs or images or descriptions by my mom.
Yeah.
And I know for a fact that as a 3-year-old and a 4-year-old, I was being read to by my mother and my grandmother.
Oh, yeah.
Mostly nursery rhymes, little stories and things like that. But I do believe that the first book story that is in my memory is Caps for Sale.
Yeah.
And I loved it so much that it would kind of come back to me over the years. You know, I'd forget about it for a decade, but then something would trigger it. And until I started buying various editions of it. So I believe very much, I think maybe it's fair to say that one way to divide the world is between those of us who are fortunate enough to have formative reading experiences early in our lives.
Yes.
That shaped who we are, shaped how we interact with the world, gave us an imagination and a memory for stories. And often took those experiences into schools, into professions, into our expression of citizenship, and all of those things. So Caps for Sale is definitely in my personal hall of fame for childhood stories.
Well, that's interesting. So there's still some aspects of the peddler and his reaction to our friends in the trees,
yeah,
that imbues who you are today. That's interesting. My earliest childhood reading memories are maybe Curious George.
Yeah.
Like that. And, but I've never gotten into trouble in my life. I was always pretty, George was a mischievous fellow. But.
So you want to get a little taste of this, this essay?
If folks didn't have a chance to read it, let's see what we got here.
Yeah, I'm going to give the Reader's Digest abridged version.
Okay.
It begins not all babies are born bald. But I was. That was 72 years ago. And what do you know? Here we are again. My dad was an amateur photographer, and I have hundreds of pictures of me. In many of the early ones, they've covered my weirdly shaped head with a diaper, an exotic headdress like Carmen Miranda's, and eventually a little baseball cap. Now, for the record, since the fact checkers and Pointer may be online, yes, in fact, I was dressed up like
Carmen.
Chiquita Banana, Carmen Miranda, the great Brazilian musical superstar. That's me at four months old, looking to the future for better days.
That's a classic.
My dad was a good photographer. Oh, I want to say something else, which has a sort of a nostalgia aspect to it, is that this photograph and many of the others that I have of myself taken in 1948 and 49, the photograph was black and white photograph, and my mother, as was a habit in the day or a craft of the day, hand colored the photograph.
Wow.
I have several of those, and they're beautiful, and they're preserved to this day. Okay.
They're not like, you know, like over rouged or something. I mean,
No. There you go. Okay. So it says here, from that modest beginning, I have become the Imelda Marcos of caps. When the First Lady of the Philippines and her husband were deposed, it was reported that she left behind 3,000 pairs of shoes. In 1987, she protested. I did not have 3,000 pairs of shoes. I had 1,060. I deny that I own more than 3,000 hats. I only have 51. I paid full price for a few and received a few as gifts. The value of the lot, say at $20 a cap, is over $1,000, which kind of, I could have bought a lot of lattes with that money. Okay. Yeah. Which invites the question, why so many hats, Roy?
Why so many hats, Roy?
Before we get to the B word, baldness, not baseball, I will list two other important reasons why I wear caps almost everywhere I go, inside and outside, so that the cap has been something, become something of a trademark. Now, so the two other reasons I will summarize quickly. One is this great blessing that Dr. Ambrose Updegraff gave me more than 30 years ago, was a surgical procedure for cataracts.
Yeah.
And my vision went from the 2400 nearsightedness, where I was at risk of not being able to pass the vision test for driving, to now, 2030 without my glasses on. So that was a great blessing. But, you know, there's a little collateral disadvantage, which is that I'm light sensitive. Okay. If I'm looking out the window and see a bright light, it can cause some irritation, a little headache. Sometimes night vision is a little bit of a problem. But wearing sunglasses simply and a cap usually does the trick. So I write about this in the column.
Okay.
The second. So after sometime this afternoon, I'm going to be visiting Dr. Mock, who is my dermatologist, to take a look at that little spot over there. You know, Floridians have, in general, those of us who have spent a little time outdoors, have to be careful about basal cell, squamous cell, skin cancer, very, very common. Easily treatable if you're on the top of it, and it helps to wear a cap, right? A little sunscreen to fend it off. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, let's get to baldness. Here we go. This section is called Our National Symbol is Bald. God has a good sense of humor. As we get older, he takes away hair from the places we want it and makes it grow in places we don't. Let it be known that when it comes to baldness, white privilege does not apply. I envy heads of color. Thank you, Michael Jordan, Steve Harvey, Shaquille O'Neal, and my friends, the Reverend Kenny Irby and Eric Deggans, even Grace Jones, for trying to make baldness fashionable, dare I say, even sexy for all of us. When you write about race these days, when you're an old white guy like I am, you need some backup. And so I shared that paragraph with journalists of color who universally laughed really, really loud. So I thought I was safe. So I was encouraged to go on a little bit. Here we go.
I always figured if I can make Eric Deggans laugh, I've done well.
Laughed really hard, I have to say. Okay. So this sexy ball thing, right? It doesn't work for guys like me. We need the hat. A pale, bald pate shows enough bumps and crevices to drive phrenologists, those quacks who measured lumps to predict personality, to ecstasy. And Bill, I'm about to read the greatest sentence I've ever written. Here we go. A caucus of bald Caucasians reveals more topography on top than a flight over the Caucasus Mountains.
Wow.
Peter Meinke, poet laureate of state of Florida.
Look out.
Stick that in your barracks bag.
Dude, when you got that, I mean, do you still, you get a sentence like that and you go, yeah, man, I got a big bass in the boat there. That's good.
I've got to kind of be careful because my latest book is called Murder Your Darlings, which is about taking a sentence like that and really judging it very clearly. Are you just including it because it's clever or does it really add to the mix?
It added to the mix, I believe. Yeah. Great.
And then it says here, that's why the last time you saw Ron Howard without a hat, he was fishing with his paw.
Right.
You know, Andy Griffith.
Yeah.
Okay. And then this is one final section. I wear a hat in the movie theater because the AC blows down and turns my bald skull into a polar ice cap. I wear a hat when I zoom because I don't want you to be distracted by the reflection off my head. I wear a hat when I teach a class because I don't want to be blinded by the overhead lights glaring into my eyes. I wear a hat at the coffee shop because I know how to accessorize, and that tie-dyed hat really pops with my white golf shirt. I wore a Providence College hat when I delivered the commencement speech at my alma mater in 2017 because the mortarboard looked so geeky. I have 6 Converse hats, my favorite brand. I have 3 Pelican hats, my favorite bird. I have 12 Tampa Bay Rays hats, my favorite team. I have 2 hats for each of these great institutions, the Buccaneers, the Lightning, the New York Yankees, Notre Dame, and most important, Bob Evans Restaurant. I am not alone, Bill. I learned that Rick Kreisman, the mayor of St. Petersburg, has a cap collection built from souvenirs acquired during his travels. He texted me that he may have as many as 50. One of my favorites is one I brought back from Havana, celebrating their 500th anniversary. Any hat from Margaritaville is a favorite, he said. Our mayor is a parrot head. Who knew? Since I began this story with my childhood, I will end it there. It's possible that the first book I ever read on my own was a classic called Caps for Sale, written and illustrated by Esfer Slobokina.
Right.
I love this story so much that I have read it to children for decades and even dramatized it for adults. Now, I summarized that. Are we going to read the book?
Did you want to read the book? Tell me why if I can find, yeah, this is an image from Caps for Sale. Why did it make such an impression on you? It's a very simple story.
Yeah, let me summarize it because I think it'll help answer the question.
Another way, so folks can see the picture while you summarize it.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
I can't really.
In the story, the peddler walks through town with a tower of caps atop his head. "Caps for sale," he cries. 50 cents a cap. He falls asleep under a tree. But when he wakes up, the caps are all missing except for one. He looks around. Then he looks up to see a tree full of monkeys, each one wearing a cap. When he shakes his fist at them or stomps his feet, they imitate him, as monkeys do. In frustration, he takes off his cap and he throws it on the ground. So do the monkeys. Off goes the peddler, selling his cap. Which makes me wonder what I might look like with 51 baseball caps stacked on my head. So, actually, I don't have to wonder that because when I would teach that story in various settings to children, I would bring in a big stack of, like, raised caps and things like that and stack them on my head. Here's what my hat collection looks like. At least most of it, not all of it. It's also...
You took a photo of it.
There they are. Organized a little bit. I put the bolts right in the front because this won the Stanley Cup. And I'm ready to for the... I got to get my World Series hat, right?
Well, time comes. We have talked before... Yeah, your World Series hat. We've talked before about... the importance of children's books early in life, you know, a good kind of reading discipline and forming one's opinion of the world. Talk to me about that because it's something you're really big on, and we've discussed this before. Let me put you in Haslam's. You tell the story.
Well, so first of all, I want to say that. I can remember this so vividly. So I was married in next year is my 50th. So 1971. Mm-hmm. And we went to Montreal on our honeymoon. And then 15 years later, we had three children by then. And Karen and I went back to Montreal for our second honeymoon, and down along the St. Lawrence River, there was a kind of like a big hangar, and in it was a shop. It was kind of a collectible shop. Mm-hmm. And I went into one of the booths, and I saw something that just caught my eye, and it was a boy adventure book. Called Assignment in Space with Rip Foster. That was the name of the book. And it was kind of like a space adventure for boys, set in the future. A group of space cadets went on this mission.
You're in trouble now, by the way.
Trying to land on an asteroid.
Okay, yeah, okay.
In order to get it for the Confederation of Good Planets, who needed radioactive material. This is by the so this is a book that I read and then my brothers read in the 1950s, and I said, "Oh my God, I haven't seen this in so long, so many years." So I purchased it. I can't remember. I might have spent $20 on it or something. And I reread it. And I was fascinated by this story because I saw something in it. It was a good adventure. But I saw something in it that I hadn't seen before, which was that it was an allegory of the Cold War. There were these, the United Confederation of Planets, and there was the consolidation and the of bad planets, you know, and they were called the commies, not the commies, but they were called the commies. And I looked at the date. This was like 1953. This was a, you know, in the middle of kind of or attached to McCarthyism, and you know, the communists were everywhere. And the author was named Blake Savage, which I was smart enough to know was not really his name. And I tracked him down. This is in the pre-digital age.
Yeah.
It turned out he was a very prolific children's author named Hal Goodwin, who had many, many government jobs after World War II, including doing field work on radiation, field work when the United States like tested an atomic bomb in the desert in Utah or something like that. He'd go out there with a suit on and measure things like that. So he was very knowledgeable about all these things. He traveled all over the world, and he wrote a whole series of boyhood science adventure space books. So I found a phone number, and I called up this phone number from Bethesda, Maryland, and a woman answered. And I kind of haltingly introduced myself. I said, do you remember Assignment in Space with Rip Foster? And she said, remember it? I typed it. And this is the wife of Hal Goodwin. And I wrote a big piece for the Times about this back in the day. And then I began a process which probably took me 20 years to complete, maybe more, which was that I tried to recreate for myself, Bill, my formative childhood library from cradle to college.
Yeah.
I went out, you know, there was no internet yet for me to kind of hunt for books online. I went to bookstores, I went to you know, all of these things, these places, and I literally purchased and many of them, not all of them, are still in my back room in this, you know, and I dip into them every once in a while to remember, to revitalize my interest. And so once again, my life would absolutely not be the same or as good if it were not for those books and the authors of those books.
Well, what does that do for you, Roy, other than being like deeply nostalgic? I mean, as an adult, you can see how they shaped the way you looked at the world.
Yeah. Very much so. Very, very much so. And so there's a theory of reading. So I don't often, when I talk to you, kind of dip into my shady career as a literary scholar. But there's a wonderful scholar, teacher, who I feature in the book, Murder Your Darlings, named Louise Rosenblatt. And she was Margaret Mead's roommate in college, at Barnard College. And she traveled the world, and she wrote, and she taught. And she developed a theory. And the theory goes like this, that the author creates the text, but the reader turns it into a poem or a story or a report. That is, that I, when I write my column, create a text, but the reader brings to the act of reading his or her own autobiography, right? So there's a so if you happen to be a white bald man, if you happen to have skin cancer, if you happen to have cataract surgery, there are certain connections that you might make. And if you haven't had those experiences, I give you the opportunity to have them vicariously as a result of reading, you know, the story. So if this is true, if this is kind of triangle of reader, of writer, reader, and text,
yeah,
what it means is that if I reread something, I have a measuring stick of how I have changed, not just as a reader, as a person. So when I read The Great Gatsby, another book that I feature in Murder, Darlings, mm-hmm. I read it, I probably read it once a decade over the last 5 or 6 decades. High school, college, graduate school, then a little bit later, yeah, midlife, my 60s. And the things that I see in it in my 60s that were invisible to me in my 30s, and especially in high school, continue to be powerfully formative. And I understand myself in a different way, not just in relationship to literature, but in relationship to love, to life, to death, to work, to America. Who could ask for more than that?
That's the value of good literature, isn't it? That it, you know, it in a way grows with you. Mm-hmm. I read The Lord of the Rings when I was maybe 14 at Tyrone Junior High School here in St. Petersburg.
Yay.
And I have not since read the whole trilogy again. It has.
Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry.
There you go. You got to get that?
Yeah, I have to call you back. I'm sorry.
Anyway,
it was probably someone reminding me that my my car insurance was running out or something like that.
Important stuff.
Exactly.
I've been sort of loath to read it again in that it wouldn't be as powerful because I was 14 and very impressionable, and it made such an impression on me. And I wonder if it would be, as you say, an even more rich experience now that I'm an old bald man too. You know, it's been a lot of years since I was 14. Mm-hmm. I don't know. And I still haven't. I saw the films and everything, but it's not the same. You know?
No.
No.
Well, I always encourage people. You know, what's interesting is that there's two ways of reading something. There's two ways of experiencing stories. One is what I would call I use the word what, like what happens. So the first time you read a story, if the story is good, it carries you forward.
Right.
Where you want to know what happens.
Right.
That's a definition, right, of that's what a page turner means. You have to turn the page because you can't stop. Or when we binge on a Netflix show that's really good, we want to know what's going to happen next.
Yeah.
But then the question is, well, if you find out what happened next, why would you bother? Tom French, I think, says he's seen Star Wars, the original Star Wars movie, like over 100 times. Like, why would you do that? Or for me, it's like My Cousin Vinny, or I really like School of Rock.
Mm-hmm.
I laugh every time.
Yeah.
And so I know what happens. I know what happens. But it has become, it's moved from a what story to a how story. There's pleasure in re-experiencing how this happened. Right? Which is why after the Rays, when they say so, beat the Yankees to advance in the playoffs in a dramatic way, I couldn't watch that winning home run too much, you know, over and over and over again.
Yeah.
With a kind of, it maintains its drama. Now there's kind of a third way of reading. So there's a kind of a what reading and a how reading. And there's a kind of a what does it mean reading? And that's the reading that we do from our memory. So I know what happens in Caps for Sale, and you do too.
Yeah.
And it's an easy enough plot to remember. But when I remember it, I'm not really no longer remembering like this happened, this happened, this happened, this happened. I have a much, you know, broader sense of how funny and interesting the story is, and how it teaches us that I'm really going to overstate it now. I may take this back. That intentionality doesn't always work to help human beings solve problems.
Right. It's just an accident.
You monkeys, you give me back our hat. And all the monkeys can do is, you give a fist, you get a fist.
Yeah.
But when you kind of express human frustration and throw down the hat, suddenly all the hats that you can get back to work.
And every time you read it, every time you, it still pleases you. I mean,
exactly.
Every time. Beverly Cleary was a favorite author of mine when I was young, and I still, like you, I went back and rebought all the Henry Huggins and Beezus and Ramona books.
Mm-hmm.
I'll take them out every once in a while.
Yeah.
And I don't really remember what happens until I get there, but it's always satisfying. We are woefully out of time. And
that went by quick.
Yeah. Always a pleasure. Let's continue this, man. Enjoy this very, very much. We didn't even get to Clack Clack Moo. So
we can devote a whole episode to that. And it will introduce to children,
yeah,
and adults, and maybe the best work, most surprising work I've ever read, that in such a humorous and interesting, fun way, reveals the power of freedom of expression and the First Amendment.
I just want to know how cows type with those hooves. I can't, all will be revealed. Let's pencil that in, man. Let's do that one very, very soon.
Okay, Bill.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you, man.
Today. Go Rays.
Go Rays.
From stpetecatalyst.com.